On this episode of This Week in Space, we're collecting cool space stuff with Robert Perlman. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 61, recorded on May 12th, 2023, Space Collectibles. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by AG1 by Athletic Greens. If you're looking for a simpler and cost-effective supplement routine, AG1 is giving you a free one-year supply of vitamin D and five free travel packs with your first purchase of a subscription. Go to athleticgreens.com/twists. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the That's Worth How Much edition. I'm Rod Pyle, Editor-in-Chief at Ad Astra Magazine, with the insurpassable Tarek Malik, Editor-in-Chief of Space.com. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I wish on the freeway I would be insurpassable. You know, people just pass me all the time, but maybe I got that wrong.
So. Well, it's probably because you're dressed like a traffic cone.
I put on a collared shirt with buttons today, right? That's like,
yes.
That's like, I mean, you know, if I had pants on, I'd be ready for work, so.
Okay. Well, enough about your orange shirt and your personal lifestyle. And by the way, I had the pleasure yesterday of doing two more episodes of William Shatner's Unexplained. And we need to get you on that show, Tarek, because it's a lot of fun. He wasn't there, but it was, you know, cool nonetheless. They're a great bunch of people.
Well, I would welcome a chance to meet the Shat himself any day.
I've never met the man. You know, they shoot us and then it's all cut in. But, well, all right, let's get right down to it. So today we're joined by the impressive Robert Perlman, who's a space historian and editor at collectspace.com. Hello, Robert.
And the dear friend. Hello. Yes.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure because you have either possession of or awareness of the coolest space stuff out there, and that excites us. Before we begin.
Plus, I've met.
Yeah.
Plus, I've met Bill Shatner. So there's that.
That's right. Bill, Rod. He said not
further
William.
Minimized. Yeah. Hey, it starts with Bill. We have a wonderful space joke today from loyal listener Matthew McCormick. I think you're going to like this one, Tart.
Okay. I'm ready. Lay it on me.
Hey, Tart.
Lay it on me, Matt.
Did you hear about the flea market they just set up around the black hole?
I did not. Tell me more.
Yeah. Some folks were there hawking radiation.
Ah, I love it.
Not bad, huh?
That is a really, really. Hey, wait. Where's the rim shot? So, there we go.
Thank you. All right.
That was a good one. That was a good
one. As always, we invite you to join Team Tarek and send us your best or worst space joke. We'll run them all. Don't forget to do us a solid and make sure to like, subscribe, and all that good podcast stuff on your podcatcher of choice because we're free and we love you. All right, let's get on to some headlines.
Do you think Stephen Hawking called it my radiation when he was like talking about it with friends?
Or, I don't know. That's very deep of you. Uncharacteristic.
Wow.
Oh, chirp, chirp. Wow. You got busted on both sides. All right. Astronomers just watched the largest explosion in space.
That's right.
Rage for 3 years. It raged. Tell us about the raging explosion.
Rage, yeah.
Space.com.
So this is really exciting. This is what scientists call a tidal disruption event. And they gave it this really, really catchy name called AT2021LWX. So at 2021 Lux. But it's 10 times brighter than any supernova that we have ever seen. It's about 8 billion light years away. So the universe was like 6 billion years old, something like that, when it exploded. Life's and good. And you know, they first spotted it in 2020, and it's still going on, which is just crazy, because mostly, you know, when they find a supernova and it blows up, you know, it lasts, you know, a few months, maybe 10 months or so, and then it fades away. You know, that was Tycho Brahe's On the New Star, right? Way back when they saw a supernova and then it faded away again. I hope I got that right. But anyway, the Zwicky Transient Facility, which finds a lot of these bursts in space in California, is the one that first picked it up. And then, And then it was picked up by the Atlas system, which is like an explosion object in space, the asteroid terrestrial impact last order. And that's based in Hawaii. And so they were able to scan the night sky and look for like a difference from one night to the other, how like astronomers used to find things like Pluto and whatnot in the night sky before we had like 24/7 eyes there. And that's what they've been tracking this every time. And they think that it's either from a supernova or a gamma ray burst or something that is out there in super ultra deep space. And it's just baffling how huge this explosion has been and then how long it's lasted. So the second longest one or the second brightest explosion was actually called GRB 221009A, and it's a bit closer and actually a little bit brighter, but this one is just much more longer lasting is what the scientists are saying. And so they think that this could be like a new kind of candle, a new cosmic milestone for people to look out for in the night sky.
I'm sorry, what's the name of that second explosion again?
The second one, sorry, I misspoke. It's called GRB 221009A. I brought it up only because it is a little bit brighter. It's a bit brighter and it was spotted later, but it's closer, but it's not as powerful as this massive one, 8 billion light years away.
Okay, well, good. Well, now I know what to have my personal license plate made up as next time. Very good. Next up, Curiosity rover finds a water-carved book, quote-unquote, on Mars, book-looking rock, which joins the canon of, let's see, so far we've had Sasquatch, an artillery piece, a rocket, Mars cheese, and I forget what the other things that people think they've spotted up there. But now we have a book carved out of rock, thanks to Curiosity.
No, there's the jelly donut that Steve Squires in his Mars rovers found. There's the lizard that they found on Mars. And now we've got this open book on the red planet. It's actually a rock area that scientists call terra firma on Mars. But we love things that look like other things, and especially when NASA is cheeky enough to push them out so we don't have to find them or have our conspiracy theorists poke them out and say, you know, the little green men left them there for us. But, you know, this is a rock that Curiosity found on April 15th, which happens to be one of my oldest friend's birthdays. So perhaps it was a present for him. But it looks really big. Like you look at this picture that NASA is showing, and it looks like it's a big book. It's got like a page sticking up and whatnot. It's actually really small. It's 2.5 centimeters across. Yeah. And they used like this microscope at the end of Curiosity's robotic arm to see it. And it's just, it's fun when even NASA has a sense of humor, you know, with these rocks that they find. You know, the wind shapes some really strange rocks on Mars, and we've seen really strange formations. And this is just another example of how weird that is. And I guess the Curiosity team is bored, right? Cause they could have, I'm sure, come up with some sort of sciencey name for it, but they'll just say, you know, it's a book, found a book on Mars. So it's just a fun one to say. And also you can see it in 3D at the JPL website where we got this from, because they released an actual separate stereo vision too, where if you have those red blue glasses from the 80s, you can get a close look. And I'm going to point out that Curiosity took this picture on its 3,800th Martian day. Wow. Of a 2-year mission, right? So what is it? It's been over a decade now that this rover has been plodding along after that initial 2-year mission.
Landed, what was it, October 2012?
2012, yeah. In August, actually, August.
August. So that will be a good one to add to our favorite space conspiracies episode, which is coming up. I'll be sure to put that in. And an interesting aside on rovers and rocks they explore, when Pathfinder landed in 97, they started naming rocks Scooby-Doo and Dino and Fred Flintstone and things like that. And it wasn't too many years later, I think it was when the MER rovers were doing their work in 2004, somebody at NASA headquarters in the legal department said, you can't name things after copyrighted characters. I thought, oh, what a killjoy, you know? I mean, if I was Hanna-Barbera, I'd be saying, hey, this is great PR for us. But unfortunately, they stopped doing that. So now this probably isn't named yet, if ever, this book rock. But most of the rocks and features are named after the geologist's favorite geological sites around the North American continent, which isn't as much fun.
Oh, no, yeah, no, it has a name. They call it Terra Firma, but what they do is they say it's a nickname. So it's not like an official name. It's a nickname.
So it won't go through the AGU or whoever.
When we got those first early pictures of Pluto, by the way, from New Horizons on the Wii, and they named some of the features like Spock and Kirk and all sorts of fun stuff, and none of that stuck, which is really, really sad. But,
yeah.
But you know, those are the days, Rod. Those are the days.
They all got Latinized because that's what we have to do, because you have to name new planetary features like you name ticks and plants that you discover in nature. Tauricus Melimaxis. All right. Last one up. Strange sounds recorded high in Earth's atmosphere from space.com. Tell us what's going on.
This is a really, really fun one. The Sandia National Labs scientists, they launched a solar-powered balloon up like 31 miles above our planet. And it's up there in the stratosphere with this microphone on it, just to do, I guess, like the science that you would do 31 miles above the Earth. And there's not a lot of storms up there, not a lot of turbulence. So it's a kind of serene place to study the atmosphere. And what they found is this really, really strange series of sounds that repeat every few hours, and no one knows what it comes from. And I wish I could sing it for you or play it for you.
Oh, but please, no.
Hey, I could be pretty good, but it's at this length called it's called infrasound. So it's at this frequency of 20 hertz. So it's way, way below what you and I can hear, below what the human ear can hear. But it's there, and they're occurring a few times an hour on some of the flights of these balloons, and they just do not understand what's going on up there. So, okay.
I think Ant is prepared to play it.
We can listen. Oh, he's got it.
Yeah. I see it, but I don't hear it yet. Here we go. Oh, okay, now it's not a little spooky.
That's clearly aliens, right, Rod?
Okay, wait, let me see if I can reproduce this. Hold on a second. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, I'll wait till Ant's done. Okay, here we go. How's that sound? Rubbing my beard against the microphone. Okay, I've embarrassed myself enough. Thank you, Ant. Thank you, Tark. Let's take a pause right now for a word from our sponsor, Athletic Greens, and we'll be right back. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by AG1 by Athletic Greens. Like countless others, I wanted to support my health without incorporating more pills or sacrificing my taste buds. With AG1 by Athletic Greens, I'm able to give my body what it craves all in one daily nutritional drink. AG1 was founded in 2010 and has been a part of millions of routines since. AG1 is the best all-in-one solution for daily nutrition, saves you time, confusion, and money, with each serving costing less than $3 a day. We all know individual supplements could quickly add up, and AG1's daily habit gives you powerful long-term results. So what are you waiting for? AG1 makes it easier for you to take the highest quality supplements, whether it's improving digestion or supporting you with sleep. AG1 really is the best bang for your buck. AG1 is a seamless, easy daily habit. Just one scoop of AG1 in the morning covers your entire day's nutritional bases. You can get all your supplements and support your long-term gut health with AG1's 75 high-quality minerals, vitamins, pre- and probiotics. As our very own Aunt Pruitt says, AG1 is a great way to start your day. Now, personally, I'd never been big on greens, just ask my mom. I wasn't the guy that ate my veggies without a lot of coaxing, and I kind of paid for it later on. But with AG1 by Athletic Greens, I've changed my tune. I actually look forward to drinking my AG1 in the morning, not only because I know it's going to help me feel great all day, but because it tastes fantastic. I've tried a bunch of similar products, and I can't say the same about any of them. And Athletic Greens is a climate-neutral certified company, so I can feel extra good about my choice. Athletic Greens believes that good nutrition should be available to all, and for every purchase, they donate to organizations helping to get nutritious food to kids in need. If you're looking for a simpler and cost-effective supplement routine, AG1 by Athletic Greens is giving you a free one-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase of a subscription. So go to athleticgreens.com/twists. That's athleticgreens.com/twists and check it out. And we're back with no more weird space sounds because now...
I didn't know we had that sound, Rod. That was great.
Isn't that cool? It's time to turn to Robert Perlman. Robert, thank you so much for coming on. I met you probably 10 years ago, I think, at Space Fest, and then soon discovered that you were the master of vintage space collections. How did you get started in that?
It's a long story, but basically, in a nutshell, it wasn't something I planned. I grew up in New Jersey, had a strong interest in space when I was a kid, but there's not a lot of space in New Jersey, or at least there wasn't back in the 80s. Fortunately, my mother was a former teacher, and she, when I was old enough, brought down from her old teaching materials newspaper clippings from the Apollo 11 moon landing. And the idea that I was holding something that was there that day, that was something that to me was a treasure because it came from my mom, but also a treasure because I thought that, you know, at that young age, I thought, well, you know, not so many people can't have this. And then it was periodic trips to the Hayden Planetarium and to other space museums where I would pick up a trinket or two. It wasn't really till I got to college that I discovered you could collect space memorabilia. There was a magazine article in an old magazine called Final Frontier that profiled a collector in Florida who had a huge space memorabilia collection. And I wrote away to him and said, how do I get started in this? And he sent a box back in return filled with memorabilia. And it was everything wow. from stamps to autographs to little pieces of spacecraft to contractor keychains and said, look through this box, find what you like and pursue that. And that sort of started the collection, started in a egg crate underneath my dorm room bed. Sort of like a goldfish. If you put a goldfish into a small bowl, it'll stay small, move into a large apartment, and suddenly you have memorabilia everywhere. and with space specifically, the items tend to grow large. So you have to be careful both in price tag and in physical size. It became a way to vicariously live through the adventures of my heroes, astronauts, and what I wanted to be and still want to be when I grow up. Each piece tells a story of itself. Interestingly, I went through a bit of a change in the last 6 months. I had a very, very large space shuttle hardware collection and decided to basically divest of all of it and change tacks to a different area, actually 4 different areas of space collecting. And I think that's what's wonderful about this. You can find different areas to collect in just about every hobby. So if you're a baseball card collector, there are astronaut trading cards. If you're a model collector, there are lots of space models of rockets and spacecraft. If you like autographs, of course, there's astronaut autographs. If you there's only a few different, very specific things that are space memorabilia, and that comes down to the memorabilia from the program itself, from NASA or Roscosmos or ESA, and then the items that came that weren't meant to be collected, that are the nuts and bolts of the program, literally the hardware and soft goods that are too small or too indescript to become museum artifacts, but are still space flown or used in the program and deserve better than being recycled into your next Coca-Cola can.
So to be clear for like our listeners, a collectible is not like a trinket I can go to the museum and like buy at the shop. It's different than that. That's what you're talking about. You're talking about stuff Go ahead.
Yeah, so there are three different terms. I'll probably on the general side, there are three different terms that you'll hear me use. And on the general side, they mean all the same thing to the public. And as it should be, memorabilia, collectible, and artifact But in specifically, a collectible is something you can buy. You can go to the store and get a collectible, whether it's a limited edition or something that you hope that will become rare as time goes on. You know, you buy an action figure and keep it mint in pack. Memorabilia is items that were created to celebrate the space program, not and be collected in some regard, but weren't for sale. So items like contractor giveaways,
like NASA pins lithographs, and patches, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then artifacts are items that were never meant to be collected. They are the physical remnants of the spacecraft and other space hardware that was created for use in the program. And then after it was no longer needed, exited the program through hopefully legal means and have entered into collector's hands.
Hopefully legal means, he said.
Well, and very well put, because that is something we should probably talk about. So I was shocked years ago. I think I was at a space fest and somebody showed me, I believe it was an early Apollo oxygen line that was a flown artifact. So it was a piece of hardware that had been up and down. And, you know, in a perfect world, probably would have ended up in the Smithsonian. But we all know that they've got warehouses like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark full of stuff that they don't display because they're out of room. Anyway, so this was an oxygen hose with a Y on the end that he claimed had been appraised for $180,000, which my breathing stopped for a few moments. My heart almost followed. And I thought, golly, this is a heck of a hobby, because you can actually make a living at it if you know what you're doing. What was your first collectible?
First artifact. Yeah. The first artifact were the little bits and pieces of heat shield that came out of that box I was sent back in college. But the first thing I purchased was an 8-inch gimbal bolt from a space shuttle main engine. It was about that long, made of titanium. It was one of 8 bolts that held the gimbal facility in place, that allowed the whole engine, if people are not familiar with gimbal, it allowed the engine to move, to position itself so that it right. could direct its thrust. And I liked it because it was, first of all, it's a much larger than normal everyday item. People knew you can know what it is immediately by looking at it. It's a bolt, and it's got a nut at the end of it. But it was much larger and heavier than what people were familiar with seeing, and told the story of, you know, now I could talk about the space shuttle main engines and could talk about the space shuttle itself. And that particular one flew on STS-72, and then later I upgraded to one that flew on STS-95, which was the mission that took John Glenn back to space.
Uh-huh.
And literally the nuts, and getting back to what I said before, literally the nuts and bolts of the space program, that's something that you won't find in a museum, because it's, you know, you might find it if it's still attached to the engine, and there are engines on display, but you're not going to find it singularly displayed, because it would take too much explanation to tell you what you're looking at. Or it might not be as interesting as looking at an oxygen hose or a full spacesuit or spacecraft sitting, you know, 2 feet away. But you're still saving that piece. You're saving it. You're documenting it. One of the things today's collectors do that really serves the museums an important process is they're able to dig into these smaller details and research and create really detailed files about who created it, what company was responsible for making it, and why was it designed in this way, and why was it used this way? Was it ever reused? That they museums don't have the time or wherewithal or budget to do. And then when museum curators or historians are looking to write about these pieces or the larger systems they were part of, these reports now become or the firsthand testimony of the collectors become important, because they're doing the little bit the research on the smaller items that would normally be ignored.
So has the space memorabilia and collectibles then been around as long as there's been a space program, or is it something that came out like later, you know, like with the stamps and whatnot, when, you know, maybe it got more public attention. I mean, is it something that's like baked into the industry, like in any industry?
There have been collectibles around, space collectibles that predate the space age. Huh. You can find old space toys. You can find books written well before there was ever a space program about the principles of rocketry and the principles of space travel. And if you're a book collector, you could go after those. There's a whole one collector put together a whole bibliography of just books written about space travel before 1957.
Wow, that's really specific.
When the space age began. But it's hundreds of pages long, which show that there's that much interest. There was that much interest back then. You can find stamps that predate the space age, depicting what they think space travel would look like. One of my books in my library is an old Boy Scout book about satellites, and it was written in 1952 before we ever put a satellite into space. And so it's all this postulation of what satellites might do in the future, and what they might look like and how we might get them into Earth orbit. Certainly there's a lot of pieces that predate, the space age itself. Of course, once we started launching items into space, once we launched Sputnik and the world's first satellites, once we put, dogs like Laika and chimps like Ham and then humans, certainly that created an even bigger demand and desire for items related to the space program. And so it's grown into a hobby, but it's still small. We're only 60 years out compared to some other collectors. You know, if you're a Americana collector and you collect Civil War memorabilia, you know, you've had a much longer time to figure out what that memorabilia is. It's not just memorabilia from the time of the Civil War, but then memorabilia created to commemorate the Civil War. And we're still within the period of the early days of space exploration. So where this hobby goes is really an unknown at this point.
And this, for like that, you mentioned you've got like pieces of heat shield, you know, or your bolts, your gimbal bolts. So I would assume that it's not as easy as just like digging through NASA's trash, like the dumpster behind the spaceport. I mean, like is there like a catalog that you can send away for? Are there auctions? How do you find the stuff if you're looking to get into, you know, having a piece of a shuttle tile or whatever that might be lying around?
Well, there's a couple of different ways. There are dealers out there, online dealers and real world dealers that will sell you space memorabilia from around the world, who have curated their own catalogs, and you can find them on the web. You can find them through our own site, CollectSpace, collectspace.com. There are auction houses that run, semi-annual or semi-quarterly or quarterly auctions devoted to space exploration itself.
And those kinds of things. You mean like that or,
So you can find it on the high end with Christie's and Sotheby's and Bonhams, and you can find, smaller auction houses like Lunar Legacies and the American Space Museum that run their own auctions, or you can find eBay has its own dedicated categories to space memorabilia and to space autographs. No matter if you're shopping at eBay or shopping at Christie's, I'd always, you know, recommend caveat emptor, you know, be a buyer beware. You should do your research before you buy and make sure that what you're buying is real and that it's represented in the right way. But you can do that. But you mentioned dumpster diving, and sometimes that's what it takes. I'll show you a piece. I'll let you first guess, if you will, at what this might be.
Well, so
space
so
food sticks. No, I don't think so.
So wait, no, it's like cheese. It looks like cheese. Is it a cheese snack?
Well, it's not food, I will tell you that.
All right, so it's like a sponge? It's
squishy, yes.
All right.
What if I do?
Airtime, airtime.
Just tell us. What if I do this?
Like a nose plug? Is it nose plug?
Similar, yes. So when you put on, when an astronaut puts on his helmet and seals his face away from his hands, if he needs to clear his ears, or her ears, they needed a way to do that. And it's called a Valsalva device. The two pieces of the sponge sort of separate in the middle. You stick your nose between it and pinches your nose so that you can clear your ears. It also makes for a great, you know, way to scratch your nose or scratch your cheek if you have an itch. anyway, this was a very unique situation, but the gentleman who had this before I did, he worked at NASA. He worked in the spacesuit lab. This came back from the mission it flew on, and it was garbage because it touched an astronaut's nose. You don't hold on to that, right? So instead of just throwing it into the garbage, he bagged and tagged it, as you can see. He then threw this into a brand new garbage bag, tied it, threw it into another garbage bag, tied that, and then threw that into the garbage. The cleaning crew came by at night, took it out to the dumpsters, and then he went dumpster diving and found his bags and took them out and held on to them for 40 years until I came along and was helping him appraise his collection. And he said, well, is it legal for me to have? And I checked with NASA's lawyers and their Office of the Inspector General. He said, as long as it's not made out of metal, because they would have gotten a recycling fee, that yes, fishing things out of the dumpster, if you have legal access to that dumpster, is legal. And so this is legally owned.
So that means to everyone listening, do not sneak onto like the NASA, like Johnson Space Center and start going through their trash.
Certainly do not do that.
Stories I can't tell. Sorry. Go ahead, Robert.
But if you're in the area of NASA centers and you see recycling facilities, it is perfectly legal for you to stop by that recycling facility or that garbage dump and say to the managers, hey, you have anything space related? Because sometimes that turns up items. That same gentleman who had saved this out of the trash went to the nearby dump, nearby recycling center here in Houston, and found two crated Gemini astronaut maneuvering units, the predecessor to the man maneuvering unit.
This is like a rocket pack
for your backpack.
The full backpack to wear. One of them is in a private collection, and the other one is at the Thomas Stafford Museum in Weatherford, Oklahoma.
Okay, just to get some of our listeners to cringe.
What would you appraise that at,
roughly?
Well, they were sold. So, I would say that they were basically between $10,000 and $20,000 items.
Oh my God.
I'd pay that much. I thought they were going to be 10 times that much.
And one of them showed up. One of them actually showed up on the one that was privately owned, was brought over to American Restoration in Las Vegas. And part of that was on that show. I was brought in as the expert to advise Rick and the team there what to do in terms of restoring it, which was do very little, because if they were to touch it, they might break it. And if more so, it showed its age, which was a good thing. But they did a little bit of work on it, touched up some of the paint, and presented it back to the private collector who collects jetpacks. And that's why he had an interest in that piece.
That's pretty specialized.
I have in my own collection.
Yeah.
I have in my own collection a collect space reader called me from Alabama one day and said, I'm at a recycling facility outside of Marshall Space Flight Center. I asked the guy if he had anything space related. He said, I've got these two hatches out back. And it turns out that what he had was the very first two common berthing mechanism hatches made for the International Space Station.
The space station door.
the largest hatch ever launched into space. These two were rejected because of manufacturing defects. One of them went to the collector who was on the phone with. The other one, he said, if you want it, it's yours. I arranged for it to be trucked, to put onto a pallet and trucked down to Houston. Had to hire movers to lift it up the three flights of stairs. It's 4 feet by 4 feet by 200 pounds. It's milled out of a solid piece of aircraft grade aluminum. But it's the largest piece of my collection. Yeah, there it is.
That would look great as a doorway to my bathroom. All right, I've got some pressing questions, but first we have to take a break to hear from our sponsors. So my personal entree into collecting was in 1969 when I think statute of limitations is up, so I can say this. I went to a newspaper rack for the Pasadena Star News, dropped in a quarter, and took probably 12 newspapers out and put them away because they, of course, were announcing the first moonwalk. My second entry was, and this will lead into my question, I had gone down to a place that used to be in Pasadena that got a lot of surplus from JPL and Caltech and other places, and they had this lovely Mark IV helmet, space helmet. Not sure whether it was ever used or not, but it does the same thing John Glenn wore, I think. I'd say model, complete with the neck ring attachment on the bottom and the cover and the whole thing. They wanted, I think, $40 for it. And I thought, God, that's a lot of money. I mean, that's newspaper route money I had, but I finally broke down and spent it. It's sitting on a shelf here. I've never had it valued, but I probably won't sell it anyway. But at some point, space hardware moved from being surplus and scrap to valued commodities. When and how did that happen?
More or less in the 1990s, a little bit, maybe a little bit earlier in the 80s, as some dealers sort of dipped their toe into the market to see if it was worth something. In the early days of the space program, there wasn't a lot of thought that this stuff would be worth a lot. Case in point, there wasn't a lot of thought that it would be historic either. Case in point, when Alan Shepard splashed down from, you know, the United States' first space flight, and they brought his Mercury capsule and its parachute back into the hangar at Cape Canaveral. They hung the parachute up in Hangar C for it to dry out. And the head of the manager of all the team members there told them at a group meeting, just go into the hangar, hoist it down a little bit, and cut off a piece for yourself. And by the end of the day, there was no parachute left, except for these little scraps in people's hands. Fortunately, the Smithsonian from very early on reached a deal with NASA saying that they had first right of refusal on anything that would be deemed an artifact. And so NASA always had to offer its spacecraft and spacesuits to NASA first, I mean, to the Smithsonian first.
Right.
And for all through up to Apollo, they took it. But it really wasn't until the middle of the 80s that space memorabilia dealers started to make a living for themselves as such, initially as mail order companies, and that a few smaller auction houses started to explore what it would be like to take consignments from that. And then by the early 90s, there was one auction house doing regular sales and a couple of dealers making a living. And it sort of grew from there. But when the astronauts first kept the items that they did, when engineers kept what they did, it was not meant as a way of retirement, making money for retirement right. or anything. It was simply keepsakes from the program they worked on.
So about a year ago, I got a call from a friend of mine who said, I've got a kind of unusual question for you. And I said, okay. And he said, I have this friend that has this model. I think he said model of Mariner 4, and he's looking to sell it. You know, do you know anybody that might want to buy that? And I said, well, first of all, is it, you know, legitimately acquired? And he said, yes. And he said, you know, you? And I said, well, you know, I've got one that came from JPL years ago that was surplused out. That's, you know, it's metal and it's made for schools and stuff. It's probably, I don't know, 2 feet across with the solar panels extended. It's not big. And I said, but, you know, I wouldn't mind looking at another one. How big is it? He said, oh, it's a one-to-one engineering twin. I said, you're telling me this is like 24 feet across? And he said, yeah. And I'm thinking, okay, I got to tell my girlfriend. So we're going to have a change in the living room decor. You know? That didn't happen. Plus, I was pretty sure I couldn't afford it. So it went, there was a suggestion to JPL for their museum, maybe. They questioned its provenance and all that got worked out. I don't know where it ended up, but Just a wild guess. What would you evaluate something like that at?
Well, its size is definitely impressive, so that helps. Yeah. But also, if you put it against the larger collection of what's out there now to collect, artifacts from the human side of the program, from human spaceflight, outperforms unmanned and robotic exploration, yeah, uncrewed exploration by tenfold sometimes. Hmm. This certainly would have been something that would have been prized by some collector or museum that wanted it. It's hard to put a value on it sight unseen. There'd really be a lot of questions about its provenance in terms of, is it really an engineering twin? Was it used in the program itself? Was it built for a museum exhibit, contemporary to the time? And to give a very wide estimate or appraisal, it could be anything from like $5,000 to $60,000 or $70,000 at auction, depending on the strength of the provenance behind it. It's items that have gone to the moon, items that have been stained with moon dust, that or items that were that have a really strong story behind them that really then cross that line into six and seven figures.
I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, specifically you mentioned like stuff that has moon dust on it, like suits, I would imagine, and things like that, tools, etc. And we just saw NASA launch a mission around the moon, and I think Snoopy, right, was on it. And it came back. And so there's stuff now from that Artemis 1 mission that I guess presumably is going to eventually make its way out there. And I'm curious what you think is going to happen with this renewed mission, you know, this renewed program to get, you know, NASA astronauts and who are going to take stuff of their own to the moon, you know, over the next few years. And then these companies that are going to launch their own missions to the moon, and some of them want to bring stuff back. And I mean, is that going to just flood the market? Is it going to be like a boom time for collectors over the next like 5-10 years of getting new stuff from the moon? Or is it less valuable because it's like new stuff?
I think it's a very interesting question. If we can use a parallel, you know, today, there are countless ways you can get things into space. There was a time not too long ago that all you needed to do to add value to an item was fly it in space. Didn't have to matter whether it had flown to Earth orbit or on a suborbital flight or had gone to the moon. As long as it was in space, it was valuable. Now, if you fly something on a suborbital flight, if you put it onto a sounding rocket that reaches space, like Up Aerospace flies out of I think New Mexico, mm-hmm. The value is much lower. That specialness has rubbed off because there's so much item. Relative to what it used to be, easier to get items into space and back. And so the value then turns to more its sentimental reasons. You know, did you have a reason to be part of that mission? Are you flying something personal of yours? Are you flying your wedding rings? And then that value is more of a personal than a market value. With the moon, certainly at first, anything that comes back from the moon is still going to have a considerable amount of value. We're not going that often. You know, even with Artemis, the amount of items that will be returned are going to be very small. And the items from that make it into public hands is going to be even smaller than that. A lot of what flies for NASA, even as memorabilia, is going to end up staying on Orion in lunar orbit and not go down to the surface with Starship because the weight restrictions with Starship are so small that they're, you know, talking about not even being able to bring back as many moon rocks as Apollo did on each individual's mission. And in fact, they're talking about on the first landing that they're not going to be able to bring back the spacesuits that are worn on the moon. So the first woman to walk on the moon, her space suit is not going to end up in a museum. It's going to end up in lunar orbit or purposely crashed into the lunar surface. And so And so we will see. At first, I think the value of anything coming back stay pretty high. It'll be after, you know, we get to the sustained portion of Artemis that we, you know, we have a sustained presence on the moon and that we're able to bring back more items. But what it might do is launch a larger demand for Apollo era items, as it'll draw attention to the fact that this is the second time we're going, and people will again do a renewed look at the first time we went and maybe want something from then as the real valued item. And they're already quite valuable. It's, you know, those are items that do cross the 5, 6, and 7 figure market auctions. And so it's not like you're going to find any steals, but it might see a bump in interest at that point.
Well, I have one follow-up to that. And it's about Artemis artifacts that get left on the moon in this environment with commercial, you know, companies on the rise. If NASA chucks the first female moonwalker's spacesuit off somewhere in Shackleton Crater, and a company goes up with a rover or whatever, a little robot, and goes and collects that up and brings it back, if they even have that capability, is that up for grabs now as a collector? Can they sell that because NASA threw it out in the trash, or no. Is the moon not a big enough trash can?
Unless NASA specifically says that they're relinquishing ownership of it, it remains their property, even if they've proverbially thrown it out with the trash.
That means that the Apollo 11 poop bags then are still his property.
You stay away from Apollo 11. For allmoonkind.com, those people are protecting that site. Yeah. Okay, I got a question.
So I'm actually on the leadership board for All Mankind.
Oh, are you? Good.
The rule is this: the 1967 Outer Space Treaty established, and the Artemis Accords now affirm that items launched into space or attempted to launch into space belong to their launching entity until they are specifically relinquished. And specifically and purposely relinquished by the entity. So, for example, when Skylab rained down over Australia, until the United States said, we do not want those pieces back, all the pieces belong to the United States. There's a reason. This is not just because the UN decided and then NASA decided with the Artemis Accords that they want to have everyone own their own items. There's a liability thing here, too. Right. You don't want a country to, you know, land your satellite on top of your house and then say, well, it was space junk. You know, we don't own it. Right. We don't have any liability. This keeps it so that the countries and in turn their entities within those countries have to be liable for any damage and cleanup that's necessary from wayward missions. Right. There's no clear framework about, because right now what the Outer Space Treaty defines is that we can't claim the moon. You can't claim any celestial body. The Artemis Accords tries to amend that by saying you can claim areas, resources that you're removing from that facility. But so what happens if someone wants to mine under Tranquility Base? Can they just push those they're not taking them, but can they push those artifacts aside? Can they destroy the footprints that were left by Neil and Buzz and say, well, we're just using the land. We're not taking anything. And that might require more treaties. Right now, NASA has published a set of recommendations that they hope all entities agree to abide by. The Artemis Accords sort of mentions those recommendations and says that countries that sign them should abide by them. It basically says to leave a somewhat of a berth around specifically Apollo 11 and Apollo 17, but more in general around any human heritage site on the moon, to be careful not to disturb them without permission.
Wow, that's a whole.
There may be someday that a scientist or NASA may want to bring some of those items back to Earth, just as, you know, we've raised items from the Titanic or you know, other historic abandoned in place items around the world. But for now, fortunately, there's not enough traffic yet to have this as a something that, you know, is an immediate concern, but it's something we definitely need to look at.
Well, that's like good. A whole other episode to think about in the future.
It's good. It's good to know that when a Long March booster stage falls on my condo, that my offspring will get some recompense from China. So just briefly, because I know it's a long story, but there's always been a little bit of murkiness around the whole Apollo 15 thing, which plays to this bigger picture of astronaut memorabilia or artifacts, things that they bring back from space or things that they use during the program going up for sale. You know, did they own it? Is it okay? Is the Smithsonian supposed to have it? It gets very murky. And I guess that kind of peaked with Apollo 15. Do I have that right?
It peaked at the time, definitely. It's less murky today. Well, with Apollo 15, what happened was the crew flew philatelic covers or stamped envelopes on behalf of a German stamp dealer. The deal between the commander of that mission, Dave Scott, and the German dealer was that the German dealer would not sell any of the covers until the program was over. In return, the German dealer provided additional covers for them to fly for themselves, as well as put a amount of money into a trust fund for their kids' education. And they weren't the first crew to do something like that. Alan Shepard flew items for the Franklin Mint on Apollo 14. In fact, Jim Lovell did the same on Apollo 13, but since they didn't land on the moon, they tried again on Apollo 14. On Apollo 12, starting with Apollo 12, another group, the Apollo Prayer League, had microfilm Bibles flown on 12 and then 13 and 14. But by the time we got up to 15, there was enough congressional insight that there was this congressional formal inquiry into, you know, were the astronauts allowed to profit off of what they were taking and were these smuggle items. All the astronauts who flew to the moon and on earlier flights had sort of an oral or even in some cases written agreement with the head of the astronaut office that they were going to keep items that were NASA did not intend to return to Earth. Specifically with the moon landings, there were items that were not meant to come back from the lunar landers. And so they wrote down the items they wanted to keep, and they then returned them themselves as weighed aloud. Neil Armstrong, unbeknownst to anyone, had a bag full, and even the bag itself had flown of artifacts off of the Eagle lunar lander from Apollo 11 that was discovered after his death. And so what happened in the aughts really was, and moving into the 2010 timeframe, is that these pieces were starting to sell at high profile auctions. And other members of the public were raising questions like, how is it possible that Jim Lovell can sell his viewfinder off of the, off of Aquarius, the Apollo 13 lunar module, for $200,000 or $300,000. We paid for that. That was taxpayer money. Why shouldn't it be ours? Why shouldn't it be in a museum? That belongs in a museum, to quote, Indiana Jones. And so NASA was in a rock and a hard place. They said to Jim and to some of the other astronauts, provide the paperwork to show that you legally own this. And there was no paperwork to show. Back in the day, it was decided that what the astronauts were doing for their personal selves wasn't the public's business. And so there was no paper trail. The Office of the Inspector General, which has oversight of NASA, said, well, we can't go by what was said back in the 60s. We have to go by what U.S. law says, and there's no proof to show these astronauts ever got permission. And so we're going to start suing them. And they did. They sued Edgar Mitchell from Apollo 14. Yikes. Over his possession and sale of a camera that was used aboard Apollo 14. And that got so far that they had to reach an out-of-court settlement where Mitchell agreed to turn over the camera to the Smithsonian. He was selling it because his son was receiving cancer treatments and the medical bills were racking up. It was not a good situation for anyone. NASA did not want to be seen suing its own astronauts. In 2012, Congress drafted, at the urging of many astronauts and others, drafted a bill, a very short, very straight to the point bill that was signed into law by President Obama at the time, that basically said astronauts of the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo eras are allowed to own the items that they brought back from their spacecraft and do with what they please, with the exception of loose lunar material. So they can't have moon rocks. And that was it. And so that settled that for that group of people. It's sort of an interesting, it created a sort of a couple of interesting questions that we're going to have to work out over the years going forward. For example, you know, John Young flew on Gemini, Apollo, and Space Shuttle. And so his Gemini and Apollo material are his to do with that as he please. But what about his Space Shuttle material? Because that wasn't covered by the bill. As it turns out, we wrote into the federal code almost the same rules or more restrictive rules for the Space Shuttle beginning on the after the Challenger accident. But for the first 25 flights, there really is no rules as to what astronauts are allowed to keep or not. So that's a question that'll have to be answered going forward. But for the most part, now today, if you're an astronaut, you're not only operating off of federal law, but you're operating off of the federal code of regulations, which restricts what you can take to space and back, and claim as your own. So you get to keep your personal items, your toothbrush, your comb, your shaver. You get to keep, maybe your pen and pencil, your eyeglasses, your shirts, anything you wear. But you can't take pieces off the spacecraft. When Mike Massimino faced a difficult point in repairing the Hubble Space Telescope where a handlebar would not come off that needed to come off, he physically tore it off of Hubble in a feat of heroic strength. And it's a great, and he has pleaded to own that piece. He's gone only as close as being able to borrow it for extended periods of time, but it remains government property.
It's at the Intrepid Museum. I've seen it there. Yeah, when it was on.
Yes, it was put on display there. So,
I was worried about taking too many pens home from the office, and this is like a whole other thing, you know, for sure. Hey, Robert, just you know, because we to ask a couple of final questions. I'm curious what the most expensive space collectible or memorabilia you've ever seen and how much that was. And then what's your pride and joy in your collection, if you're comfortable sharing that?
Sure. So the most expensive items sold are a couple of spacecraft, Vostok, the Vostok that flew just before Yuri Gagarin's Vostok 1 capsule flew, that carried a human dummy and two dogs into space. But which space.com actually had in its lobby for a short amount of time.
Oh, years ago.
Many, many years ago. Sold for a few million dollars back to a Russian oligarch who wanted to repatriate it back to the country. There was a Soyuz spacecraft that Ross Perot bought, the Perot Foundation bought, that he then loaned on long-term loan to the National Air and Space Museum, where it's on display now. Some of the Space Adventure clients that, and full disclosure, I was a Space Adventure employee, but they purchased their spacecraft at a considerable amount of money and then put them on display. You can see Greg Olson's on display at the Intrepid Sea Air and Space Museum.
Greg Olson, see, space tourist, yeah.
Yeah, space tourist. You can see Charles Simeone, both of his Soyuz spacecraft he bought, and one of them, I think one of them is at the Museum of Flight in Seattle. So those are the most expensive. But then from a memorabilia standpoint, the most that's been paid has topped out around $2 million. So $2 million was spent for the gold medallion, the singular gold medallion that was flown by Neil Armstrong to the moon as a memento of his flight. There were two other gold medallions on board, one for Buzz and one for Mike Collins, that have sold in the past but have not reached the $2 million mark. There have been a couple of watches. Dave Scott's watch from Apollo 15 that actually was an unknown at the time, labeled as an unauthorized timepiece. It was a Bulova timepiece that he took to test at the request of the head of Bulova. It turns out on his second spacewalk, his own officially issued Omega Speedmaster from NASA popped its crystal. And so he wore the Bulova watch out onto the surface of the moon. And that sold for nearly $2 million. Huh. The last few years. There was also a gold. So on Apollo, to celebrate the landing on the moon, Omega created a set of gold Omega Speedmasters, of which a subset, about 40 of them, were presented to astronauts. And those astronaut owned gold Speedmasters also topped out, with one of them selling for, I think, $1.9 million. So there's definitely, but in that case, the interest was probably more from a watch collector than it was from a space collector.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We can't say for certain, but watch collecting is really hot right now. And that probably drove up the price. In a lot of ways, you don't want to say this because you want space memorabilia to stay within the reach of everyone, but a lot of the stuff that went to the moon and went up into space on the early space missions really deserve to be selling for much more, and haven't, when you compare it to what people are paying for, let's say, a Hollywood prop. Right. So people have paid more for Marilyn Monroe's dress or William Shatner's yellow tunic from Star Trek, or or a filming model from another space movie, than they have for some of the memorabilia that's gone up. I spent more for the plaque off of the guidance plaque off the hatch that was based on the Common Birthing Mechanism hatch that appeared in the movie The Martian, than I did for the actual Common Birthing Mechanism hatch that I have in, you know, that came out of a junkyard. In a lot of ways, the market isn't mature. I think as time goes on, there'll be more and more of an increase in price as these things become rarer to own and get better appreciated for what they are. I think we live in a time, or we have lived through a time over the past 30 years, where the people that made the history were fortunately alive and with us. And that day is coming near, unfortunately, those will be gone. And so I think we've been a little spoiled by, you know, living in the time of Christopher Columbus, and he may not be exploring the waters any longer, but we all got to meet him.
Convinced me that investing in this is going to be much wiser than watching my retirement fund sit at exactly the same amount it was when I put it in years ago. So I want to know, at some point, when you're ready to sell those 5 pounds of moon rocks you have under your bed, I'm there. Do not go to Robert's place. Do not look for the moon rocks. But I do have, we'll have to talk someday, because I've got a Klingon battle cruiser from Star Trek. I worked on that show for a while. That found its way into surplus. And I got to figure out what to do with that one day. Listen, you guys, it's been grand. I want to thank you so much for coming. This was our chat with Robert Perlman, space historian and collector extraordinaire. Robert, is collectspace.com the best place to keep up with what you're up to?
Indeed. Please visit CollectSpace. Of course, you can always see the CollectSpace articles on space.com as well. But if you're interested in space memorabilia, we'd love to have you join our community on collectspace.com.
Yeah, it's a really cool site, by the way. I mean, you find some stuff on there, that discussions and not just interesting discussions, but things you would never have thought of that pop up there. And you think, oh gosh, I never even thought of that. Tarek, where do we look for you?
As always, I am at space.com on the Twitter at Tarek J. Malik. And I guess now on eBay, looking for that next great find for my own collection. I've got my, where is it? I've got my Northrop Grumman Moonlander glass here that I got from a friend of mine, but that's about it. So I'm going to have to do some research like Robert suggests.
Yawn. Yes, you do. And of course, you can always find me at pilebooks.com and at astromagazine.com. Don't forget to drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv. We welcome your comments, suggestions, ideas, and whatever else you want to talk about. Don't forget to check out space.com, the website's in the name, and of course, the National Space Society at nss.org, which own the magazine that I edit. They're both good places to satisfy your spaceflight cravings. And finally, don't forget the National Space Society's annual International Space Development Conference starts in just a couple of weeks in Dallas, Texas, Dallas area, Frisco, technically. If you're interested in attending, go to isdc23.nss.org for more info. And if you do decide to drop by, please say hi, because I'll be there all week, as the bad comedians say. New episodes publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher. Be sure to subscribe. Tell your friends and give us reviews. We'll take them all. And don't forget, you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free at Club Twit, as well as some extras that are only available there, including, yes, you're going to hear it again, Tarek falling off his chair. Just $7 per month, and it's worth it just for that.
Well, at least you didn't catch me singing this time. So
there we go. Thank God. You can also follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter, and on Facebook, and twit.tv on Instagram. Thank you so much, everybody, and we'll see you next week.
Oh, hey, that's a really nice iPhone you have there. You totally picked the right color. Hey, since you do use an iPhone, and maybe use an iPad or an Apple Watch or an Apple TV, well, you should check out iOS Today. It's a show that I, Micah Sargent, and my co-host Rosemary Orchard host every Tuesday right here on the Twit Network. It covers all things iOS, tvOS, HomePodOS, WatchOS, iPadOS. It's all the OSs that Apple has on offer, and we love to give you tips and tricks about making the most of those devices, checking out great apps and services, and answering your tech questions. I hope you check it out.